Welcome back to Practically Intelligent. I am your host, Sinan Ozdemir, and with me is usually Akshay, but this week he is taking a well-deserved vacation. So I will be introing you all to our most recent interview with Rich Skrenta, the executive director of the Common Crawl Foundation. If you've never heard of Common Crawl, it is a gigantic open source repository of data that virtually every LLM you've ever used has at some point used that data from. We talk about the past, history, present, and future of Common Crawl. So take a listen. All right. We're welcoming Rich Skrenta, Executive Director of Common Crawl, to Practically Intelligent. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Really happy to chat.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into everything that you're working on now. And I promise to everyone listening, we are going to get there. But I think it's really crucial that we establish a bit of a through line here. Because Rich is not someone who just kind of wandered into AI one day and said, I think I can take a crack at this. You know, so many leaders these days, I think, have that mindset of AI is this new technology. It's going to enable me to do all these new things. You know, I don't need all that experience to really make this work. But Rich is, for me, really the opposite of that. So I want to first start by asking you to tell us and our listeners just a little bit about your history, specifically about your philosophy and history with data aggregation, specifically for AI and machine learning systems. Because I think it's a really fascinating history, and I think our listeners are really going to love that.
Sure. Well, I've been working with search and aggregation for, I guess, decades now. And I've gone back and forth between startups and very large companies multiple times. I sold a little search engine to Netscape way back in 1998. And I sold a news search engine to some newspaper companies in 2005. And then I decided I wanted to compete with Google. And so I built Blekka, which was a full-scale consumer search engine, which we ended up selling to IBM Watson in 2015. And these were all really interesting projects because we had, millions of users on these sites. So we sort of had all the issues with content moderation, copyright, access to data, and dealing with those both as a startup and inside of large enterprises that have, lots of lawyers and scrutinize everything was interesting. And then most recently, before Common Crawl, I worked at Meta, where I was running Knowledge Graph, which entailed a web crawler. And I also ran a system that looked for basically bad URLs that are posted on their family of apps to see if they're in policy or out of policy. But these were vast systems with hundreds of machine learning engineers, hundreds of billions of pieces of content a day, and really a footprint in almost every country in the world, in every language, jurisdictions all over the place. So fairly complex policy requirements to operate them effectively. But then when I left Meta, I took some time off because I realized that I'd done about six startups in my career and worked at five very large companies. And I don't think I'd had more than 2 weeks between any of these jobs. And so I said, well, maybe I should just, before I run back into another burning building, I'll just take a few months to gather my thoughts. And while I was doing that, Gil Elbaz, the chairman and founder of Common Crawl, put out a post and he said, hey, I'm looking for a new executive director for this project. And I'd known Gil for many years, and I was certainly aware of Common Crawl. We'd worked with them at Blekka. But I thought, well, this is really interesting because Common Crawl, it's sort of a unique animal. It's a nonprofit foundation. Gil, after he left Google, had this vision that web crawls should not be closed source, that they should be open source, open data. And so he started this project to crawl the web and give it away for free. And I think when he started it, he had this idea that somebody would download the data set and make the next Google. And that didn't really happen for 15 years. I think really until LLMs came along. So it was sort of a sleepy project for most of its life. It's immensely useful, tremendous resource for researchers. It's cited in over 10,000 research papers. People have used it for machine translation, all sorts of things. But I'm starting about 2 years ago, it turned out that LLMs just have this voracious appetite for training tokens. And Common Crawl at this point is a massive data set, 250 billion pages spanning the 17 years. It's nearly 10 petabytes. So it turns out it's one of the largest or maybe the largest corpus out there for LLM training at the moment. And I thought, wow, this is kind of a really cool project. Common Crawl is like not just a national treasure. It's almost, you know, a global treasure. It's a global resource. And it's been non-commercial for its entire existence. We've never charged a penny for our byte out of our data. We crawl very politely. Our robot, which is called CCBot, takes great pains to, you know, be a polite citizen of the web. Consults robots.txt, doesn't accept cookies, doesn't bypass pay gates or log in. It only archives pages that have intentionally been put on the web so that people can see them. And it's not a complete copy. Each month we go out and try and pull in, I estimate it's like 5%. You know, let's do another academic sampling of the web and add to the archive. So it's been exciting. I started about a year ago, and it's been a lot of fun in working with a lot of partners on the AI side to see what they want. We've had requests to do things like push into underrepresented languages, like the little languages in Europe, like Catalan. There's 500 sub-regional languages in India. There's areas where our web graphs are not as strong. And so we want to make sure that we have a proportionate, you know, representation of the world's content to the extent we can.
Yeah. And frankly, it's noble. And my first question is actually based on exactly that thought, which is, so for reference for everyone, Common Crawl was originally founded in 2007. So this is not necessarily a new organization, but to your point, Rich, after you've been on for about a year, you have been expanding not just the actual data set itself and thoughtfully so. You've also expanded in at least in my experience and what I've seen, you've also been expanding in trying to make access much more easier to the data set. You know, if you go to their website right now, go to the Common Crawl website, you'll see dozens of examples of, you know, notebooks of people using it, examples on how to get it from S3, which you can get totally for free through Amazon. So can you talk us through a little bit more about that overall philosophy of, I'll put in your words, of trying to become a global treasure, right? What is now potentially, definitely, I would say, a national treasure. What are those steps into becoming a global treasure? Because I think the first step is diversity and representation, right? Making sure that you are at least representing global data in certain ways, whether you measure that through languages represented or, you know, websites represented around the world. But what are the steps in your mind? What's the pipeline to become that global treasure?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, one of the first fires that we were fighting when I joined last year was that our Common Crawl's hosted in Amazon. They give us a generous hosting support for the data set, which would be quite expensive if we had to pay for it ourselves. So we were definitely very grateful to them. But it turned out our S3 bucket was on fire. And so when we put out a new data set, so many people were coming to get it. And these monthly dumps are so large that everyone was just getting, you know, access denied because the S3 bucket couldn't withstand the inbound number of requests. In fact, last year when we put out our September update, we started getting 11,000 requests per second against the S3 bucket. And then, unfortunately, some of our, you know, users are not being malicious, but they're just so eager to get it that they spin up more instances on their side to try and, you know, slam it. And so the number of requests per second went up to 1 million, which I didn't even think was possible, because those are big numbers from where I come from. But I guess CloudFront is pretty effective at scaling. But we were able to work with Amazon engineers and identify hotspots in the process and correct them. And so at this point, when we put out updates now, it's a pretty smooth process. But that was sort of step one. Like if you can't download the data set, obviously that's not
just ops, basically.
Exactly. So like, let's fix that. But then on the diversity front, we're just having lots of conversations with different organizations, frankly, around the world about what they would like to see in the data. There are things like, and I don't know how technical we want to go. Maybe, you know, you could let me know.
Tell us, please.
You want to go into. But there's sort of two versions of the data set in the bucket. There's the raw HTML, which is quite large, and then there's an extract, and those are called the work and the wet files. And the wet file is just the text from the page. You know, if you did the boilerplate extraction, got rid of the HTML, whatever JavaScript or CSS might be on there, and just took the tokens or the text that you wanted to work with.
From the body specifically, or just the entire page?
Well, you know, if you think about like a, you know, a news site, right, there's typically, you know, a C clamp navigation, stuff like that. Mm. And so, you know, yeah, just taking kind of the text extract out.
Gotcha.
And so a lot of people prefer to use those files for two reasons. One, so that they don't have to do the extraction themselves, which is expensive to apply to the entire HTML archive. You know, this, the extract is about 5% of the size of the, of their overall stuff. So it's just easier to get. And then, yeah, and they don't have to pay for it. However, you know, our extract is, it's okay, but it's not great by modern standards. So it turns out that LLMs benefit from things like paragraph breaks and section headings and bulleted lists, you know, that, that light markup that might exist on the page. Is very useful to them. They actually get signal from that. And then there's other dimensions that are interesting that we've been talking about, like instead of doing page level language identification, could we do paragraph level language identification? Because sometimes, you know, there's a page that's got multiple languages on it, or even sentence level language identification. And can we upgrade our language classifier to be more comprehensive and more accurate? So those are the kinds of conversations we've been having with folks. And then we've had a number of requests just to make the thing bigger, like crawl more frequently, crawl more pages. But more, we want to do that in a way where the where we can maintain the quality. Because, you know, sometimes when you get deeper into a site, you start to get pages that are less relevant. So we want to make sure that we have metrics in place so that, that as we do expand the breadth and depth of the crawl, that the quality won't suffer.
One thing, Rich, it's kind of, we have this new audience around AI where Sanan and I have been talking about, is that a lot of folks with a background in ML are, and training models are very familiar with Common Crawl, but new application developers may not. You know, some stats here, you know, I think 83% of GPT-3 training tokens leverage Common Crawl's data corpus. I think you mentioned the most, or one of the most publicly used S3 buckets in the world. We talked about that transformation. It's a recent realization of how, you know, how Common Crawl can be used for some of these foundation models. How has the mission of the organization changed over the last 2 years, and currently where does that sit?
Well, I think our mission is consistent. You know, we want to provide this academic sampling of the web. You know, we were crawling every 2 to 3 months, and we've actually just gotten back to the monthly cadence. So we started a new crawl at the beginning of this month, and you know, we intend to launch those every 30 days. So we're excited about that. We do want to increase the size of the crawl, but yeah, we want to work with people to say, you know, what features on the page can we be extracting that are more useful? Are there particular languages where we might be weak? There's issues where the, you know, the web graph seed might not just have a lot of Catalan in it. You know, there just isn't as much Catalan as there is English. But then there's other weird technical factors, like if we crawl from US East 1 in Virginia, sometimes, you know, the website in Catalan will actually, you know, it'll GeoIP us and show us English instead. So because we're crawling from the US, it biases the crawl to more US or more English content rather. So, you know, how do we address that? Well, you know, small matter of engineering on different fronts, but if we can make the crawl better in any way, and not just better for LLMs, but also for these other really important applications like machine translation, you know, like if you want to go and translate, you know, any two languages between say 230 languages on the global internet, it's really useful to have a clean corpus that's well labeled to be able to support that.
I want to come back to something you said earlier, Rich. Pretty recently. You're calling Common Crawl an academic sampling of the web, and that's a phrase I have not really heard before being used to describe Common Crawl. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means to you and the organization? Like, is the idea that this is something strictly meant for academic purposes, or do you foresee and encourage non-academic use cases for this kind of data? Because, you know, as a teacher, obviously the academic use cases are clear. This is easy data access for an NLP class that I would teach that, you know, that people would take. But I guess what are you thinking kind of beyond that, if anything?
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I guess I am kind of using a novel $5 word to talk to describe the approach. But let me say what I mean by that. I think instead of academic sampling, I could say a general purpose sample of the web. And by sample, I mean it's not comprehensive. And it's deliberately not comprehensive. Each monthly crawl, you know, there's sort of all the pages that we've ever crawled in the past. And then there's the pages we know about that we haven't crawled yet, which is about 100 times the number that we've crawled. That's the crawl frontier. And the crawl frontier is vast. So each month, the ranking algorithm will go in and its goal is to crawl 50% recrawls of existing pages that we've seen in the past to see if they've changed, and 50% new pages from the frontier. And we want to rank those. We want to rank both of those in an interesting way. But we're deliberately not taking a comprehensive snapshot of every site. You know, we go in and we say, well, you know, maybe we got 100 pages from this site in the past and we know about, you know, 10,000 ones that we haven't gotten. Well, let's go take, you know, 200 more pages and add it to the list. And, you know, what could you do with that? Well, researchers do all sorts of studies. If you go to Google Scholar and do a search for Common Crawl, you'll see the 10,000 citations, 10,000 plus. People have built search engines against the index, but it's almost not an ideal corpus to build a search engine with, because you're not going to have every site or every page in every site. So if there's something that you're looking for, it might just not be in there. Mm-hmm. So if you had a focused application, you know, where there's a particular, you know, website or narrow data set that you want for your, you know, whatever it is you're building, you know, you're probably better off going and, you know, doing a deal for that data with, you know, a company that has it, or going, you know, crawling that material yourself so you can get an accurate and up-to-date copy. So we're kind of like, you know, we're sort of vast, but not necessarily comprehensively deep is maybe another way to put it.
Well, right. Because in a lot of ways, it's the idea of building an academic sample or just, you know, a representative sample of some population is, especially when that population is the internet, is vast, if not literally impossible, because the internet's always growing and there's always, you have to catch up. And the idea is, well, if you could just index the entire internet, well, that's kind of Google's mission. They really want to index literally everything on the internet, because that is what a search engine is, you know, kind of for. But this is actually why I really wanted to start with your history, because even as far back as Bleco, and probably even before that, you can correct me, the idea of curation has always been a part of the companies that you start and are a part of, because the philosophy that data for the sake of data is not always going to be helpful. And especially if you're trying to train an LLM, well, sure, we could give it the entire internet if we could, but why waste the compute and the time when we could give it a representative sample and still achieve similar benchmarks and similar performance? So that idea really resonates to me. And I'm curious if that is, if that's also what's driving this current mission to expand even more globally, when you're talking to these people abroad and figuring out where you should be pointing your crawlers and where the crawl frontier will live for now. What have been some of the pushbacks, if any, or challenges, is particularly with trying to creep into that crawl frontier, as you put it, globally? What kinds of conversations and challenges have you had to face?
Yeah, really, really interesting questions. And let me say two things about that. One is, I was talking to a senior ML researcher in the industry, and he threw an idea at me that probably 5% of the crawl is worth 95% of the effective training in the AI systems.
Exactly.
And this has come up with, you know, thinking about the carbon footprint of the crawl, which is correlated with your cost to run jobs against it on AWS, right? It's a lot of money to go process 250 billion pages. So if we could find the 5% of those pages that were the most effective, that would be really helpful, right? That would save people money, and it would save the planet electricity and heat. And we have a contributor to Common Crawl who recently put out a blog post about this that's linked from our site about trying to actually measure the carbon footprint of Common Crawl. But in terms of the verticals, at Blecko, that was sort of our differentiator. We said there's a couple of thousand interesting verticals that have a lot of SEO contention because they have high economic value. So, things like travel, medical queries, shopping queries, and there's just so much spam in these categories that it's sometimes hard to find the good stuff among the noise. We had, luxury goods searches or Honolulu hotel, but you misspell Honolulu, online RN degree, so sometimes these searches are just, there's just too much junk there. And we have a concern that with LLMs now adding a lot more machine generated content to the web, it may be difficult if you're just looking at a document and just going from the document level signals to tell whether it was written by a human, whether it was written by an authoritative source, whether it came out of some kind of spam engine. And the spam engines are probably going to 100x now. So we're thinking that it could be interesting to make subslices of the data set where we have curated the quality sites within verticals like medical, like travel, and then we could sort of offer people not just a relevant slice for the content that they want, but one that's going to be substantially smaller because it's just taking that slice out of the entire internet, and then it would save them a lot of time and money to process.
That idea is actually interesting. I read a paper recently, end of last year. I think it was from Rice that specifically looked at that data poisoning idea, where if you have some kind of generative AI putting out generative content into the training pool set, and then you kind of keep using that iteratively over a few generations, what is the result? And specifically, they use image generation because I think it was just kind of easier to see the degradation over time. But they came to the conclusion that the active data poisoning, even at a very small level, can be pretty detrimental to generations of models. And they really specifically tested this by forcing an AI to kind of retrain on a training pool that it itself contributes to over and over again. And even at very, very small rates of contribution of AI data, you see pixel deformation like pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And you see little kind of, six fingers becomes nine fingers. I made that up. But what was already a problem just becomes worse. And I think that idea of that curation and not just for the sake of diversity, but even just for the sake of maintaining quality and high performance and efficiency in data. Anyone who's read books on NLP knows that feature processing is one of the most important steps of NLP. You don't just take raw data and use it as is for the most part, right? You have to extract it. In this case, you have to, scan it for certain, certain inconsistencies and make sure that it's matching what you were going to say. So I really do appreciate that. I do want to eventually come back to that question, though, of the challenges that you faced in that expansion. But I think Akshay had a question I wanted to.
No, I was going to take it a different direction, son. Go ahead.
Well, great. Let's come back to that then. I am genuinely curious about some of the challenges that you've, or just even pushbacks, if you faced any, quite frankly, because I think as you're expanding, I have to imagine that certain countries, copyright laws, licensing laws, something eventually has to get in the way. And I guess it could be as simple as, because you are a conscientious internet citizen, following the robots.txt and being fair on the internet, maybe that just kind of mitigates all of that. But have there been any explicit challenges in going abroad?
I would say I wouldn't make a distinction between the U.S. and abroad, because it's kind of a general concern. The U.S. Copyright Office put out a request for inquiry last fall into, I think they got like 35,000 opinions from from people. So there's many voices that are kind of weighing in on this. I mean, our view is that, we're crawling the open public web, and, we see ourselves as archivists. We're assembling, books in the library, basically. But if you go make a product, you should obey the laws wherever your product is. And, you know, like folks have said to us, like, well, hey, maybe you want to go and label harmful content like hate speech. And we're like, well, you know, not necessarily, because there's valid reasons why researchers might want to measure the relevance of hate speech in certain markets. But if you go make a, you know, a chatbot that, you know, is talking to people, it should not, you know, be using that content. But that's really at the point of application. But there's so many different applications in so many different markets and jurisdictions and languages that I don't know how we could even effectively try and come up with, you know, the ultra pure data set that covers all of them. And with respect to, like, I mean, there's, you know, there's copyright, but then there's like PII, you know, people's names. And so when I sold my search engine Blecko to IBM Watson, their, you know, external lawyers, you know, asked me, you know, you don't have the names of any Europeans in this data set, do you? And I said, well, of course we do. You know, it's billions of pages from the internet.
There are quite a few of them. I don't know if you've heard.
there are people's names in the data set. There's song lyrics. There is copywritten content. I mean, everything is copywritten. People say, well, can you make a safe subset? There won't be anything left. It'll be 0.1% of the size. And then you'll have lost the L in your LLM. Because you know it needs to be large for the magic to work. But if you know, I was talking to a consulting partner who, you know, brought up a question of like deploying LLM tech in an air-gapped on-prem HIPAA compliant data center for a customer. And their lawyers are like, well, we don't want this trained on any PII. And I'm like, well, guys, if you want, you know, the magic thing to be able to recognize names, it needs to know what a name is. It needs to have seen, you know, billions of names. I mean, that's how it works. Now, that's not to say that machine should emit PII, obviously, but that's kind of, you know, when it comes out, not how you train the model. If you swap a human in for that component technology, right, you're going to hire, you know, let's say a person, like a 25-year-old person to do the job that your LLM's doing, right? Well, what was the life experience of that person? How do they form the mental models in their head? Well, they, you know, watched TV and listened to music and went to the library and read newspapers. And, you know, they ingested this enormous amount of content, boiled it down into mental models, and then they can apply it at work. But they can do it responsibly, right? They join a company, they give you a policy document, and they say, here's the rules on how to use this stuff. But that, again, it's at the point of application, not at the point of learning. And that's where we come back to sort of, you know, we think that LLMs, AIs, Common Crawl should have a right to read the open public internet, and there should be a right to train and a right to learn against this data set.
One thing, Rich, I think it's interesting in sort of these seminal shifts in software, whether it was the operating system, whether it was, you know, underlying databases and software, and then now with data, there tends to be a, you know, rethinking of business models and how important open source is, more on that. It is really important, but the relationship between end consumers, whether it's enterprises or users, and software changes, you know, the Linux Foundation, it's hard to imagine the, you know, the history of, you know, operating systems and personal computing without the Linux Foundation. Right. And so I guess, you know, we talked about copywriting, et cetera, and this right to train. I'd be kind of curious how you're seeing a lot of you know, business model shift as a result of changes in relationships to, you know, a right to access some of this data, right? If you look at, most of us will be sort of familiar with, you know, OpenAI paying for, and different, you know, companies paying, you know, mountains for access to data. Most, you know, the average sort of listener or that has less machine learning experience will more be more familiar with Reddit's, you know, now starting to basically license out their data. And then that's now under FTC investigation. So my question would be, with all these changes, there seems to be an underlying, you know, this right to open data is in question, and it's uncertain where that future is headed. And I'm curious if you can just opine on where you think that is headed, and where you think, you know, Common Crawl certainly has a perspective on where that should be in the future.
Right. Well, yeah, it's an interesting time. I think, you know, the risk with, you know, saying that you have to do private deals to get all this data is twofold. One, that's going to limit, you know, who can access the data to the, you know, to the very richest companies. And, you know, open source models, researchers, students won't have access to that content. But the other issue is it doesn't scale to the size of the web. I mean, if you imagine, let's say you're a biz dev guy at some AI startup and you want to go out and start doing content licensing deals, you know, how many can you realistically do is that biz dev person? Now, let's say you wanted to make a product that operated in 130 languages. Like, do you have to go into each of those markets and do those deals too with, like, you know, every newspaper in the world or something? It's not really feasible. It doesn't scale to the size of the internet. People just don't appreciate how large the internet is. And, you know, if you just take a small, you know, sub collection of content, it's not going to have the breadth for the models to be able to train, you know, learn a language model, learn a world model, and then generalize. I think an interesting way this is going right now is with RAG, right? Where you have you train your big model against, you know, the open corpus, and it learns a world model, and it learns a language model. And it, you know, you can even get facts to come out of it if you're sort of in the popular center of the data set, if you're in a popular topic. But if you get out to the periphery of a less popular topic, you know, it starts to make things up. But the second problem is that these models take so long to train that if you want current accurate data for something, like, say, you know, prices on, you know, some product list, it's sort of useless for that because it takes 200 days to train the model. So then doing the second step where you do RAG against a private collection of data that has high quality current information, and then, you know, maybe even use another LLM model to summarize the results for the user. I've seen a couple of startups that are doing that sort of thing. So I think that's an interesting way this might go.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You know, usually when we think about this access and data, we think about it in terms of model access, pre-training and training these models. One thing I think, Rich, is people a lot of times don't appreciate the scale of the internet, both physical and, you know, software infrastructure that goes into it. It's sort of this right that, you know, we've taken for granted. And I think a lot of times with this change in how data is treated on the internet, it's hard to almost imagine, obviously with new ML model development, this is clearly going to have an impact. But with a lot of our changes and data becoming less open, I think people are, it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on maybe what concerns you if some of those trends continue and we don't have someone and stewards and contributors like the folks behind Common Crawl supporting the right to an open data. How will users, access to the current internet and certain applications, et cetera, change, both new AI-enabled applications and ones that users have come to love?
Well, that's right. I think, you know, the internet was, you know, was created in, what, 1989, 1990 by Sir Tim Berners-Lee. And I actually had the opportunity, Common Crawl went to attend an EU Open Web Search event that was at CERN in Geneva last year. And they actually have the original web server, the very first one, which is an XCube, in their museum.
That's cool.
And had a little piece of paper that had been taped over the thing that said, please don't turn this off. You know, it's powering this new this new thing on the internet. But, you know, when the internet was created, the idea was that we wanted to make access to knowledge globally available, that it would make the world a better place. And so these are open protocols. And I think it would be a real shame if we lost that, right? If this had been a finite experiment and we lost access to the open web. And that's kind of like why I object to the term scraper, right? Because when you say you open your web browser and you go to the New York Times, you don't use the word scrape. It's not, you know, Safari's not scraping the New York Times. It's using standard open internet protocols to access the content that has been put on the internet so people could see it and access it with permission. And that's the same thing Common Crawl does. So I think if you kind of come back and say, well, we're not allowed to do that anymore, it's going to shut down so many applications and so much research that it's going to be a real step backwards.
Awesome. So one last question to kind of culminate all of this into something a little bit more in the future, forward-looking. Rich, given all of this, given your history with not from the conception of the internet all the way to Common Crawl, the idea of providing access to information, data, repositories of information. What are we in store for in the future with Common Crawl and with organizations like Common Crawl? Like, what can we look forward to both as an academic side, from an academic side of things, and to the practitioners side of things? What do you have in store for us?
Well, as I mentioned before, there's a lot on the data side, on the tech side, that we're working on. Having better coverage of global languages, superior extract, an extract that's smaller, just so you don't have to spend $200,000 to iterate over the data set, and sort of like, you know, pre-extracted slices, like per language or perhaps per topic. I think that will just make it all much more accessible to researchers or, you know, everyone in industry to be able to get their hands on the data and use it. But then we would also, we're also working on the policy front. There's a whole bunch of folks we're talking to, because a lot of the framing that's coming out of the mainstream press is sort of simplistic, right? You know, it's like, okay, evil web scrapers are stealing creators' content to train murderous robots. They're going to kill us all. That's sort of the default narrative that's coming out of some of the major news outlets. But I don't think that's very thoughtful, right? That's not three moves down the chessboard. And it's not helpful to get to a place where, if we want to have, you know, a useful medium between, you know, or a collaboration between folks that are building these really important systems and, you know, systems that could be some of the most significant technology things that have been created for mankind. You know, researchers like Jeff Hinton says, you know, this is equivalent to fire or the atomic bomb or the wheel. And so if you say, well, you know, we're concerned that, you know, I don't want you to read my website, you know, if we're not careful, we could be hindering the development of, you know, fantastic technology that will benefit us all. And I'm AI positive. I think that the machines, you know, are more likely to help us, you know, cure cancer or deflect an asteroid than turn into, you know, movie robots with red eyes.
Yeah, I think we agree with you there.
if we want them to be best aligned with us, you know, the way to teach them to behave is not to take books out of the library or restrict their access to read content. It's to give them as much content as we possibly can so that they will share our values.
Yeah. I think one thing, Rich, is on that AI positive note is that I think it's almost, you know, just talking about the history of the internet, it's almost impossible now for someone to conceptualize a non-open internet and kind of rewrite that history because it had such positive influences on innovation and daily lives, et cetera. And it really is through the work of actually, you know, the open source community and contributors that a lot of that history was shaped that way and the underlying technology was shaped that way in research. And then similarly, you know, you and your work at Common Crawl, I was kind of surprised to learn when you took over, it was only a few people really supporting the project. And now it's becoming this seminal project that's becoming increasingly important to the future of open data and the internet. So where can people contribute, support, et cetera, get involved in supporting this project in the future?
Yeah, we have a lot of folks that help us out on the open source side. All of our code is open source. You know, the data is completely open as well. But we have a mailing list and a Discord, so folks can come in there. And we talk to folks around the world all the time about their ideas for projects. But also, I think, you know, on the policy front, for people to make their voice known, right? You know, to the extent that legislation is being considered in the U.S., in, you know, the EU and around the world, you know, people should let the folks that are guiding the, you know, those draft legislations know that they think it's important to keep this, you know, access to the open internet open. You know, we don't want to go back to the days of AOL and CompuServe, you know, and that's the only way you could get online, you know, with your modem. You know, we want to go forward, not back in that way.
Awesome. Well, we will drop a link to several ways you can
and all the links
where you can find Rich and Common Crawl. But Rich, thank you so much for taking the time today to chat with us. This was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.